Chapter 2. We have had potato cakes with eggs and sausage. A wonderful meal. It is 2 years since I last saw an egg, and potato cakes, God only knows. Comfortable and full, we now sit around the big table in the living room, drinking coffee with saccharin. The lamp is burning, the canary singing, the stove is warm, and under the table, Wolf lies asleep. It is as lovely as can be. Now, tell us all about your experiences, Ernst, says my father. Experiences, I repeat, and think to myself, I haven't experienced anything. It was just war all the time. How should a man have experiences there? No matter how I rack my brains, nothing suitable occurs to me. A man cannot talk about the things out there with civilians, and I know nothing else. You folk here have experienced much more, I'm sure, I say, by way of excusing myself. That they have indeed. My sisters tell how they had to scrounge to get the supper together. Twice the gendarmes took everything from them at the station. The third time they sewed the eggs inside their cloaks, put the sausages into their blouses, and hid the potatoes in pockets inside their skirts. That time, they got through. I listened to them rather absently. They have grown up since last I saw them. Or perhaps I did not notice such things then, so that I find it the more remarkable now. Ilse must be over 17 already. How the time goes. Did you know Counselor Pleister was dead? Asks my father. I shake my head. When was that? In July, about the 20th, I think. The water is singing in the kettle. I toy with the tassels along the fringe of the tablecloth. So, July, I think to myself. July. We lost 36 men during the last 5 days of July. And I hardly remember the names of 3 of them now. There were so many more joined them as time went on. What was it? I ask, feeling sleepy from the unaccustomed warmth of the room. H.E. or machine gun? But he wasn't a soldier, Ernst, protests my father, rather mystified. He had inflammation of the lung. Oh, yes, of course, I say, setting myself upright in my chair again. I forgot about those things. They recount all the rest that has happened since my last leave. The butcher at the corner was half killed by a mob of hungry women. At one time, the end of August, there had been as much as a whole pound of fish to a family. The dog at Dr. Knott's has been taken away to be worked up into soap, like as not. Miss Mentrup is going to have a baby. Potatoes are dearer again. Next week, perhaps, one may be able to buy some bones at the slaughter yard. Aunt Greta's second daughter was married last month, and to a captain, too. My sister stops short. But you aren't listening at all, Ernst, she says in astonishment. Oh, yes, yes, I reassure her, and pull myself together. A captain, quite. She married a captain, you said.
Yes, just think of it. Such luck,
my sister runs on eagerly.
And her face simply covered with freckles, too. What do you say to that now?
What should I say? If a captain stops a shrapnel bullet in the nut, he's a goner, same as any other sort of man. They talk on, but I cannot marshal my thoughts. They will keep wandering. I get up and look out the window. A pair of underpants are dangling on the line. Gray and limp, they flap to and fro in the twilight. The dim, uncertain light in the drying yard flickers. Then suddenly, like a shadow, remote, another scene rises up away beyond it. Fluttering linen, a solitary mouth organ in the evening, a march up in the dusk, and scores of dead Negroes in faded blue greatcoats with burst lips and bloody eyes. gas. The scene stands out clearly for a moment, then it wavers and vanishes. The underpants flap through it. The drying yard is there again, and again behind me I feel the room with my parents, and warmth, and security. That is over, I think to myself with a sense of relief, and turn away.
"What makes you so fidgety, Ernst?" asks my father. "You haven't sat still for 10 minutes together."
"Perhaps he is overtired," suggests my mother.
"No," I answer, a little embarrassed. "It's not that. I think perhaps I've forgotten how to sit on a chair for so long at a stretch. We didn't have them out at the front. There we just lay about on the floor or wherever we happen to be. I've lost the habit, I suppose, that's all."
"Funny," says my father.
I shrug my shoulders. My mother smiles.
"Have you been to your room yet?" she asks.
"Not yet," I reply, getting up and going over. My heart is beating fast as I open the door and catch the smell of the books in the darkness. I switch on the light hastily and look about me.
"Everything has been left exactly as it was," says my sister behind me.
"Yes, yes," I reply in self-defense, for I would rather be left alone now. But already the others have come too, and are standing there in the doorway, watching me expectantly. I sit down in the armchair and place my hands on the top of the table. It is smooth and cool to the touch. Yes, everything just as it was. The brown marble letterweight that Carl Vogt gave me, there in its place beside the compass and the inkstand. But Carl Vogt was killed at Mount Kemmel.
"Don't you like your room anymore?" asks my sister.
"Oh, yes," I say hesitatingly. "But it's so small." My father laughs.
"It's just the same size that it used to be."
"Of course, it must be," I agree. "But I had an idea it was so much bigger somehow."
"It is so long since you were here," says my mother.
I nod.
"The bed is freshly made," she goes on. "But you mustn't look there yet."
I feel for my tunic pocket. Adolf Bethke gave me a packet of cigars when he left us. I must smoke one of them now. Everything around me seems to have come loose, as if I were a bit giddy. I breathe the smoke deep into my lungs and begin to feel better already.
"Smoke cigars, do you?"
asks my father in surprise and almost reprovingly. I look at him with a certain wonderment.
"But of course," I reply.
"They were part of the ration out there. We got 3 or 4 every day.
Will you have one?"
He takes it, shaking his head meanwhile.
"You used not to smoke at all before."
"Oh yes, before," I say, and cannot help smiling that he should make such a story out of it. There are a lot of things I used not to do before, that's a fact. But up the line there, one soon lost any difference before one's elders. We were all alike there. Stealthily, I glance at the clock. I have only been here a couple of hours, yet it feels like a couple of weeks since I last saw Willy and Ludwig. For my part, I should like to get up and go to them at once. I am quite unable to realize that now I must stay here, in the family, for good. I still have the feeling that tomorrow, or maybe the next day, but surely sometime, we shall be marching again, side by side, cursing or resigned, but all together. At last I get up and fetch my greatcoat from where it hangs in the passage.
"Aren't you going to stay with us this evening?"
asks my mother.
"I have to go and report myself yet," I lie.
I have not the heart to tell her the truth. She comes with me to the stairs.
"Wait a moment," she says. "It is very dark. I'll bring a light."
I stop in surprise. A light? for those few steps. Lord, and through how many shell holes, along how many gloomy duckboard walks, have I had to find my way at night all these years without light and under fire? And now a light for a few stairs. Oh, Mother. But I wait patiently till she comes with the lamp and holds the light for me, and it is as if she stroked me in the darkness.
Be careful, Ernst, that no harm comes to you out there, she calls after me.
But what harm could come to me at home here, Mother, in peacetime, I say, smiling and look up at her. She leans over the banister. Her small, timorous face has a golden light upon it from the lampshade. The lights and shadows dance fantastically over the wall behind her. And suddenly, a strange agitation takes hold on me, almost like pain, as if there were nothing like that face in all the whole world, as if I were a child again that must be lighted down the stairs, a youngster that may come to some harm out on the street, and as if all else that has been between were but phantasm and dream. But the light of the lamp concentrates to a flashing point in the buckle of my belt. The moment has passed. I am no child. I am wearing a uniform. Quickly, I run down the stairs, three steps at a time. I fling open the outer door and hurry out, eager to come to my comrades. I call first on Albert Troske. His mother's eyes are red from weeping, but that is merely because of today. It is not anything serious. But Albert is not his old self either. He is sitting there at the table like a wet hen. Beside him sits his elder brother. It is an age since I saw him last. All I know is that he has been in hospital a long time. He has grown stout and has lovely red cheeks. Hello, Hans. Fit again? I say heartily. How goes it? Nothing like being up on your pins again, eh? He mumbles something incomprehensible. Frau Troske bursts into sobs and goes out. Albert makes me a sign with his eyes. I look around, mystified. Then I notice a pair of crutches lying beside Hans's chair. Not finished with yet? I ask. Oh, yes, he replies. Came out of hospital last week. He reaches for the crutches, lifts himself up, and with two jerks swings across to the stove. Both feet are missing. He has an iron artificial foot on his right leg, and on the left just a frame with a shoe attachment. I feel ashamed at my stupid talk. I didn't know, Hans, I say. He nods. His feet were frostbitten in the Carpathians. Then gangrene set in, and in the end they both had to be amputated.
Thank God it is only his feet, says Frau Troske,
bringing a cushion and setting it under the artificial limb.
Never mind, Hans. We will soon put it right. You'll soon learn to walk again.
She sits down beside him and strokes his hands.
Yes, I say, only to say something. You still have your legs, anyway.
That's what I say, he answers.
I offer him a cigarette. What should one do at such moments? Everything seems brusque, however well it is meant. We talk a while, halting and painfully. But whenever Albert or I get up and move about, we see Hans watching our feet with a gloomy, anguished gaze, and his mother's eyes following his in the same direction, always only at the feet, back and forth. You have feet, I have none. He still thinks of nothing else, and his mother is wholly taken up with him. She does not see that Albert is suffering under it. No one could stick that for long.
Albert, we ought to be going along to report now, I say, to give him a pretext for escape.
Yes, he says eagerly.
Once outside, we begin to breathe again. The night reflects softly in the wet pavement. Streetlights flicker in the wind. Albert stares straight ahead.
There's nothing I can do about it, he begins. But when I sit there between them like that and see him and my mother, in the end I get to feel as if it were all my fault, and am ashamed at still having my 2 feet. A man begins to think he is scum just for being whole. Even an arm wound like Lutfig's would do. Then perhaps one wouldn't seem such an eyesore standing about there. I try to console him, but he will not have it. What I say does not convince him, but it gives me at least some relief. It is always so with comfort.
We go to find Villy. His room is a wilderness. The bed has been dismantled and stands upended against the wall. It has to be made larger. Villy has grown so much in the army that he does not fit it anymore. Planks, hammers, saws lie strewn all around. And on a chair there glistens an immense dish of potato salad. He is not there himself. His mother explains that he has been out in the scullery a whole hour, scrubbing himself clean. Frau Hohmeyer is on her knees before Willie's pack, rummaging through it. Shaking her head, she hauls out some dirty rags that were once a pair of socks.
Dreadful holes, she murmurs, looking up at Albert and me disapprovingly.
Cheap stuff, I say with a shrug.
Cheap, indeed, she protests bitterly. Shows how little you know about it. It's the best wool, let me tell you, young man. 8 days I was running up and down before I got it. And now see, through already. And you won't find their like anywhere.
She contemplates the ruins with an aggrieved air.
I'm sure there must have been time at the war just to pull on a pair of clean socks quickly, at least once a week. 4 pairs of them he had last time he went out, and now he has brought back only 2. And look at them!
She passes her hand through the holes. I am just about to take up his defense when he himself enters in triumph, announcing at the top of his voice,
There's a piece of luck for you! Another aspirant for the Order of the Dixie! There's going to be fricasseed chicken tonight, lads!
Waving in his hand like a flag is a fat cock. The green golden tail feathers gleam. Its comb glows crimson, and from its beak there hang a few drops of blood. Though I have had a good meal, water begins to gather in my mouth. Villy swings the creature to and fro blissfully. Frau Hohmeyer straightens up and utters a shriek.
Villy! But where did you get it from?
Villy announces with pride that he saw it behind the shed. Caught it, and killed it all inside 2 minutes. He slaps his mother on the back.
We did learn something out there, you see. Villy wasn't acting deputy chief cook for nothing, I tell you.
She looks at him as if he had murdered a child. Then she calls to her husband.
Oscar,
she moans in a broken voice.
Come and look at this. He has killed Binding's pedigree cock.
Binding? What Binding? Asks Villy.
The cock belongs to Binding, the milkman next door. Oh, my God, how could you do such a thing?
Frau Hohmeyer sinks down on a chair.
I wasn't going to leave a good roast like that just running about, says Villy in astonishment. Not when I had him as good as in my hand already.
Frau Hohmeyer is not to be comforted.
There'll be trouble about it, I know. That Binding man has such a terrible temper.
But what do you take me for?
Asks Villy, beginning to feel really slighted.
Do you think I let so much as a mouse see me? I'm no novice, you know. This makes just the 10th I've swiped now. A jubilee bird, you might say. We can eat him in perfect comfort, and your Binding won't know one thing about it.
He shakes it affectionately.
You will taste good. Do you think I should boil him or roast him?
Do you imagine I would eat one little bit of it?
Cries Frau Hohmeier, beside herself.
You take it back at once.
I'm not quite balmy, explains Villy.
But you stole it,
she laments desperately.
Stole it?
Villy burst into laughter.
That's a nice thing to say. Commandeered, this was. Boned. Picked up, if you like. But stolen? When a man takes money, then perhaps you can talk of stealing. But certainly not when he just bags a little bit of something to eat. In that case, we would have stolen a lot in our time, eh, Ernst?
Sure, Villy, I say. He just ran out to meet you, I dare say. Same as the one at Staden that belonged to the OC number 2 battery. Remember? And you made fricasseed chicken for the whole company out of it. Half and half. To one hen, add one horse. That was the recipe, wasn't it?
Villy beams and taps the stove plate with his hand. Cold, he says, disappointed, and turns to his mother. Haven't you any coal, then?
Frau Hohmeier cannot speak for agitation. She can only shake her head. Villy reassures her with a wave of the hand.
Never mind, I'll scrounge some tomorrow. For the moment, we'll make do with this old chair here. It's pretty wobbly, you see. Not much good for anything more, really.
Frau Hohmeier looks at her son uncomprehendingly. She snatches the chair and then the fowl out of his very hands and makes off with it to Milkman Binding's. Villy is righteously indignant.
So, off he goes and sings no more, he says sadly. So you understand that, Ernst?
I understand well enough that we may not take the chair, though up the line we once burned a whole piano to make a dapple-gray horse come tender, and that at home here we must not yield to every involuntary twitching of our fingers, though out there everything eatable was looked on as a gift from God and by no means a problem in morals. Perhaps I can understand that also. But that a fowl that is already dead should be taken back to where the merest recruit knows it can only cause a lot of unnecessary trouble, that seems to me just plain madness.
If it isn't the custom, then we must starve. That seems to be the way of it, eh?
Says Villy, quite nonplussed.
And to think we might have been having fricasseed chicken inside half an hour, if only we'd been on our own with the boys. I meant to serve white sauce with it, too.
His eye wanders from the stove to the door and back again. The best thing for us to do would be to make ourselves scarce, I suggest. Looks to me as if there's a strafe brewing. But Frau Hohmeier is back again already.
He isn't at home,
she says out of breath, and all excitement. She is about to open her mind further, when suddenly she notices that Villy has put on his things. Immediately, it all is forgotten.
You aren't going away already?
Just for a little bit of a patrol, Mother, he says, laughing.
She starts to weep. Villy, rather embarrassed, slaps her lightly on the shoulder.
I'll be back, all right. We'll always be coming back now. A bit too often, perhaps, I shouldn't wonder.
Side by side, our hands in our pockets, we set off at a swinging pace down Castle Street.
Shouldn't we collect Ludwig?
I ask. Villy shakes his head.
Nah, let him sleep. That's better for him.
The town is disturbed. Motor lorries filled with sailors go roaring through the streets. Red flags are flying. Bundles of handbills are being unloaded and distributed in front of the town hall. The people snatch them from the hands of the sailors and glance through them eagerly. Their eyes shine. A gust of wind swoops down upon the packages and sends the sheets whirling up into the air like a flock of pigeons. They catch in the bare branches of the trees and hang there, rustling.
Comrades, says an old chap in a field gray overcoat. Things will be better now, comrades.
His lips are quivering. Hello, looks as if there's something doing here, I say. We set off at the double. The nearer we approach to the cathedral square, the denser is the throng. The square itself is crammed with people. A soldier is standing on the theater steps and making a speech. The chalky light of a carbide lamp is flickering on his face. We cannot understand properly what he is saying, for the wind sweeps over the square in spasmodic, long-drawn gusts, each time bringing with it a wave of organ music in which the thin, halting voice almost drowns. A vague, tense excitement is hanging over the place. The crowd stands like a wall. Almost all are soldiers, some of them with their wives. Their silent faces have the same grim expression as when they peered out across no man's land from under their steel helmets toward the enemy lines. But something more is in their look now. Hopes for a future. Elusive expectancy of a new life. Shouts come from the direction of the theater and are answered by a subdued roar.
That's the stuff, cries Villy joyfully. Now the fun begins.
Arms are raised. A sudden tremor passes over the crowd. The ranks begin to move. A procession forms itself. Shouts, cries,
forward, comrades!
Like an immense deep sigh, the sound of marching rustles over the pavement. We swing into line automatically. On our right is an artilleryman. Ahead, an engineer. We form up, squad by squad. Few of us are known to the other, yet at once we trust each other. They are our comrades. That is enough.
Come, Otto, join in,
shouts the engineer in front of us to one who as yet has not moved. He hesitates. His wife is with him. She slips her arm into his and looks at him. He smiles awkwardly.
Afterwards, Franz,
Villy pulls a wry face.
When petticoats appear, comradeship's finished. You take it from me.
Ah, rot, protests the engineer, giving him a cigarette.
Women are one half of life, but there's a time for everything, of course.
Automatically, we fall into step. But this is another kind of marching from that we have been used to. The pavement echoes, and like lightning, a wild, breathless hope sweeps over the column, as though the road would now lead us straight on into the life of freedom and justice. But already, after only a few hundred yards, the procession stops. It has halted in front of the mayor's house. Some workers rattle at the outer door. All remains quiet, but the pale face of a woman is seen a moment behind the shut windows. The rattling increases. A stone is thrown at the window. A second follows. Splintered glass falls clashing into the front garden. Then the mayor shows himself on the balcony of the first floor. He is greeted with shouts. He tries to protest, but none will hear him.
Come out! Come with us! Cries somebody.
The mayor shrugs his shoulders and nods assent. A few minutes later, he is marching at the head of the procession. The next to be hauled out is the chief of the food control office. Then a bewildered, bald-headed fellow who has been profiteering in butter. We missed nabbing a corn dealer. He shut himself up just in time when he heard us coming. The procession now marches to the castle and piles up before the entrance to the district headquarters. A soldier dashes up the steps and goes inside. We wait. The windows are all alight. At last, the door opens again. We crane our necks. A man with a portfolio comes out. He turns out some sheets of paper from his case, and in a monotonous voice begins reading a speech. We listen intently. Vili puts both hands to his great ears. Being a good head taller than anyone else, he follows the sentences more easily and repeats them aloud. But the words prattle away over our heads. They echo and die away, but they do not touch us. They do not sweep us away. They do not stir us. They only prattle and prattle away. We begin to grow restive. We do not understand this. We are accustomed to act, but the fellow up there only talks and talks. Now he is exhorting us to calmness and prudence, but then nobody has been imprudent as yet. At last he goes off. "Who is that?" I ask disappointedly. The artilleryman beside us knows everything. "President of the Workers' and Soldiers' Council. Used to be a dentist, I believe." "Aha," growls Vili, turning his red head uncomfortably from side to side. "What a frowst. And me thinking we were off to the station and then straight to Berlin." Shouts begin to come from the crowd. They multiply. "The mayor! Let the mayor speak!" He is pushed up the steps. In a calm voice, he explains that the whole matter is being thoroughly looked into. Beside him, stuttering, stand the two profiteers. They are sweating with fright. But nothing is done to them either. They come in for some round abuse, but that is all. No one takes the trouble to lift a hand against them. "Well," says Vili, "the mayor has his courage with him anyway, I'll say that much." "Pooh, he's used to it," says the artilleryman. "They drag him out like this every few days." We look at him in astonishment.
"You mean this happens often?" asks Albert.
The other nods.
"There are always fresh troops coming back, you see, who think they must put matters right. And, well, that's all that comes of it."
"Damned if I understand that," says Vili.
"Nor me either,"
adds the artilleryman, yawning largely.
"Expected something different myself, I admit. Well, cheer-o. I'll be trotting along to my flea bag, I guess. That's the most sensible thing to do."
Others follow suit. The square empties perceptibly. A second delegate is talking now. He also advises calm. The leaders will see to it all. They are on the job already. He indicates the lighted windows. The best thing would be for us to go home.
"Well, damn my eyes. So that is all?" I say peevishly.
We begin to feel rather absurd for having joined in with the mob. What did we want exactly when we came here?
"Ah, hell," says Vili, disenchanted.
We shrug our shoulders and slope off. I walk home with Albert and then return alone. It is very strange. Now that my comrades are with me no longer, everything around me begins to sway gently and become unreal. A while back it was all matter of fact and sure, and now it has suddenly come loose. It is so perplexingly new and strange that I hardly know whether I may not be dreaming at all. Am I here? Am I really here again? Home. There are the streets, cobbled and sure, smooth, gleaming roofs. Nowhere the gaping holes and gashes of shells. Undamaged, the walls tower into the blue night. Gables and balconies silhouetted against it, making dark shadows. Nothing here has suffered the teeth of war. Window panes are intact, and behind the bright clouds of their curtains lives a hushed world, very different from that howling place of death where till now I have made my home. I come to a stand before a house where there is light in the lower windows. Muffled music is coming from it. The curtains are but half drawn, and I can see inside. A woman is seated at a piano, playing. She is alone. The only light is from a standard lamp, and it falls on the white page of the music. The rest of the room is lost in a colorful gloom. A sofa, a couple of armchairs and cushions suggest a peaceful life there. On a settle, a dog lies asleep. I gaze like one enchanted. Only when the woman stands up and moves noiselessly to the table do I step back hastily. My heart is beating fast. In the wild light of the rockets and among the shattered ruins of frontline villages, I had almost forgotten such things existed. Such street-long, walked-in peace of carpets and warmth and women. I should like to open the door and go in and curl myself up on the settle. I should like to stretch out my hands to the warmth there and let it flood over me. I should like to talk and to thaw out there the hardness, the violence, all the past, to leave it behind me, peel it off like a dirty shirt. The light in the room goes out. I walk on. But suddenly the night is full of dark cries and indistinct voices, full of faces and things gone by, full of questions and of answers. I wander far out beyond the limits of the city, and stand at last on the slope of the Klosterberg. Below lies the town, all silver. The moon is reflected in the river. The towers seem afloat in the air, and all is unbelievably still. I stand a while, and then go back to the streets and the houses. Quietly, I grope my way up the stairs that lead to my home. My parents are already asleep. I hear their breathing. The soft breathing of my mother, and my father's heavier, and feel ashamed I have come back so late. In my room, I make a light. In the corner is the bed with fresh linen sheets, the covers turned back. I sit down on it, and so remain for some time lost in thought. At last, I feel tired. Mechanically, I stretch out and make to pull up the blanket. I sit up again suddenly. I had quite forgotten to undress. At the front, we always slept in our clothes just as we were. Slowly, I take off my uniform, put my boots in a corner. Then, hanging over the end of the bed, I perceive a nightshirt. I hardly recognize the thing. I put it on. And all at once, while I am still pulling it over my naked, creeping body, my senses overwhelm me. I stroke the sheets. I bury myself into the pillows. I hug them to me, press myself down into them, into the pillows, into sleep, into life once again. And I know one thing and one only. I am here. I am here.